There's going to be a meeting on the Eastern Seaboard in the fog with someone from like Big Cinnamon and Equifax Workforce Solutions and Starbucks being like, we've got to shut this place down.
There are 3,000 listeners going to storm the gates.
Well, hello and welcome to Optimist Economy. I'm Catherine.
I'm Robin.
On this show, we believe the U.S. economy can be better and we talk about how to get there one problem and solution at a time.
At the top of the show, we make a few announcements. First, we've added a support us page to our Substack. It'll tell you all the ways that you can support our show financially. We have two new spiritual sponsors to shout out this week. First, Monica Dwyer of Ohio and Christopher Moore of Dallas, Texas. Our next chapter is Retcon, Retroactive Continuity. This is where we talk about things that we should have talked about before. And this is all going to be Catherine this week.
Yes, that's why Retcon's kind of my section. I wanted to say we published the show on cash, and something that I, man, really should have brought up in real time is that in the study, most of the moms were working. So
this is the cash for kids study that was looking at poverty.
In the baby's first year study, I neglected to mention in the part where we talked about it for a long time that most of the women were working, and if they were working, they were working at least 30 hours a week. So the conclusion that we shouldn't give women cash, we should just help them find jobs, like really doesn't apply to this group of women because they had such high work rates. And then we had a listener write in that they felt like the kind of conservative conclusion from the baby's first year study was less that we shouldn't help them, but that moms should help themselves. That point is also hollow because most of the moms are working, and if they were working, they were working full time. And so there's this like handout versus hand up doesn't work when you're in a very low paid job like they were. The second thing is that part of the kind of sweeping comprehensive study that is baby's first year, they are part of qualitative studies as well that interview them about their experience receiving the money and, you know, how they spend it and how they feel about it. And for what it's worth, these women have said in the baby's first year program, who are getting $333 a month, that they want help with childcare. And when they think of the type of support they need, they listed out their top three ask were family-friendly work policies, childcare, and safe recreational activities and spaces for their children. I thought that that was definitely like a very telling and frankly fitting request from low-income mothers, is that they want their job to be easier to maintain their families. They want to have a safe place to put their kids when they're at work, or a safe place to play with their kids when they're not. And they're lacking all three. Yeah. And that was what they asked for. They didn't ask for more cash. They wanted the government to do more for families. And they're not alone. And it's a point that's lost on a lot of people, that we spend so much time disparaging low-income people and people in poverty, but their request would be, you know, pretty similar to mine. Family-friendly work policies, childcare for my kids, and a safe place for them to play and grow and interact. All right, after Retcon, we do terms and conditions.
We sound super high energy today.
We sound super high energy. I'm in agony. So I'm like, I'm trying to maintain composure as it is getting physically hard for me to talk. We just gotta get some words out.
So for those of you who are listening on the podcast, Catherine's in a little bit of discomfort due to the fact that she's got this very large baby growing inside of her. So apparently I'm going to take on our next chapter by myself, which is called Terms and Conditions. What did I look up this week, Catherine? I know you want to ask. I looked up the word SPIV. This came up in a novel that I read, and I had never seen it. And the context was something like, she had grown up wealthy, but since her father had lost everything, she had become something of a SPIV. And SPIV is English slang, British slang, for a particular kind of petty criminal who sort of exists by their wits rather than holding down a job. So this came into use in the early 20th century, but became prominent in the World War II era in England, related to kind of well-dressed, slick-looking guys who would trade in the black market on goods that were rationed. So a spiff is somebody who could always get their hands on things that nobody else could get their hands on. And in the case of the novel, she's sort of the spiffish character is a little bit of a shoplifter and makes homemade cannabis products on the side.
So is it negative?
It's not good. Yeah. It's criminal for sure.
Okay.
Lightweight petty criminal.
Lightweight petty criminal. Spiv.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So following up on the discussion last week about the sort of state of the jobs market and how we got to where we are, this week we wanted to talk a little bit about unemployment, specifically unemployment insurance, which people do just call unemployment, but it is a specific program. And as a little backstory, this is the topic that introduced me and Catherine 5+ years ago. We met online on Zoom at the very beginning of the pandemic when we were talking about what were the issues to be looking out for in the months ahead. And Catherine piped up out of the clatter of all these other issues and said, and the unemployment system is completely broken.
And it still is. So
I was going to say, so my first question is, did anything change after the crisis of 24 million people being thrown out of work and the slow response of unemployment systems that are run through the states on COBOL?
A lot changed and then it went back. So actually making the program robust requires state legislatures to either raise their taxes or raise their benefits or both to come up with a better kind of safety net for people who are unemployed. And the vast majority of them have not touched it. In fact, some have been cutting their benefit.
They've actually made it worse.
Yes. Now, the Biden administration spent a ton of money and effort on modernization and really trying to help state governments work basically outside of legislation to make improvements where possible. Mm-hmm. There's only so much that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's only so much that the states can do, or there's only so much that the people running unemployment insurance systems in their state can do without legislative support.
Yeah, exactly. You have people who administer and implement the program versus people who vote on it. And the changes that unemployment insurance needs is votes. Mm-hmm. What Biden pushed through was what they could get done outside of state legislatures, but you need a state legislature to vote on actually raising the benefit to an adequate level, which they didn't do.
And that, to your mind, that's the big change that needs to happen as opposed to expanding who gets it or...
Yeah, so unemployment insurance is a social insurance program. In some ways, it's similar to Social Security. It's funded by a payroll tax. In this case, it's just paid by the employer, not employer and employee. It's paid into a trust fund. The trust fund funds the benefits, and the benefits are apportioned out to workers based on their individual work history. So how much you get from unemployment insurance depends on how much you worked, how much you earned, and then the state has some formula for determining the benefit amount and the benefit length. So it's a similar model to Social Security, but much worse, because instead of being run by a federal agency, it's run individually by each separate state government. So, you know, imagine that Social Security, instead of having one Social Security, there were 50 Social Security programs. Each state had their own version. And if you put that on a timer for 70 years, do you think it would be good or bad? Bad. The answer is bad. It has the same model of Social Security, but just so much worse execution.
Mm. Can you give me an example of like sort of the extremes in generosity and stinginess in these between states? Like, is it really different from one place to another?
So the broad intention of unemployment insurance is to replace about half of your weekly wage. You can only get it if you lost your job through no fault of your own.
Mm-hmm.
So no quits, no firing for cause, and no new entrants or re-entrants. These are just people who have had employment paid into the system, and their employer verifies that they lost their job through no fault of their own because there were layoffs or the firm closed.
Can you stop and explain what new entrants and re-entrants are?
New entrants would be like a college graduate or a high school graduate.
People who is newly entering the workforce in general.
Yeah, they've never worked before.
Okay.
And then a re-entrant would be someone who has not worked in a while but is coming back.
Coming back into the workforce.
Someone who was in prison for 5 years and is now looking for a job, they don't get anything.
Got it. So what about somebody coming out of the military?
The military has its own unemployment system. When you are discharged from the military, you can apply for unemployment. It's based on the state that you move to, and the federal government pays back the state for your benefit. Mm-hmm. So unemployment insurance is what I wrote my dissertation on. Like, Catherine, PhD, labor economist, like, I cut my teeth on unemployment insurance. Like, this is the program I studied the most. And so in the pandemic, when unemployment insurance becomes so important to pandemic relief and yet has all these endemic problems, I was just catapulted to a level of like media and policy influence that like I was completely not expecting, because even in bad recessions, no one cares about this program. During the pandemic, I was briefing a group of state-level policymakers that included a former governor. And I talked about how I had been having meetings with like state governments all over the U.S. trying to give them advice on their unemployment insurance program and the effect it could have on their local economy. And this governor said, "I'm so glad you're doing that, because as you know, we don't care about it at all." And I was like, "Wow, I am so glad you told me that, because that confirms what I had felt to be true, which is that no governor is like, I'm so proud that we're so good at helping unemployed people."
Yeah, I'm sure they don't even think about it.
Unless they want to cut it. Right? So, yeah, I mean, Rick Scott, the former governor of Florida, like made it like a mantle of his tenure as the governor of Florida that he was going to make the program as awful as possible. And there's clips from him like at some kind of like youth conservative conference, and he's bragging about how Florida was able to successfully cut their unemployment program. He's like, "Guess how many people are on Florida's unemployment insurance program now?" And like, true to everything wrong with how people perceive unemployed people, some kid says like 5 million. And he like looks at you and he's like, "What is wrong with you, kid?"
How many people today, just throw out a guess, how many people when I left office were on unemployment benefits? 10 million is one. Anybody else? 61,000. All right.
Yeah, I mean, this was like a point of pride that Florida had successfully cut the program. Most states just ignore it. There are a few exceptions. Washington State has a good program. New Jersey has the best program. And Massachusetts probably has the most generous. Hmm. But one way to see the difference across states is in the maximum benefit, where like I have this replacement rate of based on your past earnings. So say you made $52,000 a year. Okay. And your average earnings was $1,000 a week. And you lose your job and you apply for unemployment insurance. The formula is going to be some function of transforming $52,000 mm-hmm. a year and $1,000 a week into a benefit amount.
Okay.
And that formula has a cap. Mm-hmm. Where like you can get a weekly benefit that is 1/52nd of your average annual earnings up to $200.
So why do the formula? Like,
yeah, so the lowest cap states historically are Mississippi, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. And the highest cap states are Massachusetts and Washington. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference, too. It's the difference of, say, a maximum benefit in Massachusetts that's over $1,000, you know, almost $1,100 versus Louisiana, which is, it's around $230 a week.
Good Lord.
Oh, yeah. It's shameful. So one of my like big break pieces of a column I wrote in the pandemic was that I pointed out that if you were to take the maximum benefit across states and just apply that to a simple weighting system where you looked at where Black people actually lived, the average white benefit and the average Black benefit were $1,000 off.
Wow. Yeah.
Over the course of an unemployment insurance spell. Because the states that have the most Black people have the least
benefits.
Generous benefits. And the states that have, you know, very few Black people tend to have the most generous benefits. And so if you were to just reweight the population based on what their maximum amount of unemployment they could get, the total maximum amount over an unemployment spell was $1,000 less for Black people. Now, to be fair, white people in those states are also not doing great. But it's where like a disproportionate share of Black people live in states that have really low unemployment benefits. This is not novel. This is just something that I happened to point out, you could do the same thing with the minimum wage.
Mm. Does that mean if you were employed in one state and moved to another, you would forfeit your benefits? So like, say I live in California, I got laid off from my job, I decide I'm going to move to Nevada because I think I can get a job there.
No, you apply for unemployment wherever the job site is.
Okay.
So like, let's say I live in New Jersey, but I work in New York.
Yeah.
And I go from Hoboken or Union City and I go mm-hmm. into New York City and that's where right. my job is and I get laid off. I apply for unemployment in New York State.
Because that's where the company is based.
Because that's
and it
and
doesn't
that's
matter then if you move out of New Jersey and move to Pennsylvania.
No, it's wherever the unemployment insurance taxes were paid, which typically mm-hmm. is where the physical work site is. That is the state that determines the benefit.
Got it. I mean, what do you think people miss? Ordinary people, not state legislators who don't care. What do you think that
and
people
governors.
Miss? And governors. Well, I know I am curious about their motivation in cutting unemployment insurance. It just doesn't seem like the savings should be so great. If it's 12,000 people who are on unemployment insurance in Florida, or whatever the number is, that being stingy pays off that much for the state. Is it just bragging rights?
Okay, I think there's like some people who are like Republicans trying to make a name for themselves by like cutting benefits for unemployed people as a way to say that like we're kicking those lazy people off of the government dole and making sure that they get to work. I think for most of it, it's just neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't care. They yeah. don't want business taxes high. Unemployment insurance was created in the Social Security Act of 1935. And for the first, I mean, basically 30 years of its existence, it coasted on the fact that it was taking in like war chest of money and paying out little in benefits because it went through things like the wartime production maximum employment where wages were spiking and nobody was losing their job, right? So you mm-hmm. had all these people paying into the program. And then we have massive expansions to the program as well as labor laws that see this blossoming of wage growth in the 1950s. And it's only until you get to the 1970s that like these war chests start to run dry.
Mm-hmm. There's a war chest in every state.
There's a war chest
because it's set up this way. Okay, yeah.
There's 53 separate trust funds for states, D.C., the Virgin Islands.
Puerto Rico.
And Puerto Rico. So between 1973 and 1981, the U.S. had three recessions. And in between, they had stagflation and a weak economy. And unemployment insurance really starts to show its structural weaknesses. Like the trust funds were running out of money, but states didn't want to raise payroll taxes in their state during such a weak economic era, which is a perfectly legitimate concern. Developing in tandem comes these economic arguments that the benefits are too generous. The program isn't suited to the modern economy. It needs to be redesigned around what the 1970s labor market looks like and not what the 1930s labor market looks like. And then in parallel, there's also just a blossoming of language around how lazy the unemployed are and how they're grifters and they're just trying to live off the government. Oh my God. Actually, I have an amazing story about that. Hold on.
Story coming from the bottom shelf there. Uh-huh. Eruption.
Eruption.
The untold story of Mount St. Helens. Have you been there? It's amazing.
No, I've never been.
I remember the explosion. And then we went on a trip through Oregon a few years ago and actually went to the national park. And I had no idea how powerful this eruption was and why people were kind of still in the way of it. And it's great if you're ever out there.
So just a little bit of timeline orientation for all the optimists in case Mount St. Helens 1980 eruption isn't front of mind. The mountain starts shaking and showing pre-volcanic activity in March. So you have about a two-month period where state and local and federal agencies are trying to decide how much do we need to evacuate, where do we need to clear off safe zones, and so on. And in the middle of this falls a set of loggers who are working on the side of the mountain for a logging company. The death toll of Mount St. Helens would have been 10 times what it was if it had not blown on a Sunday, because there were loggers working on the mountain in the blast zone that were basically told they had to keep working. And so if it had been Monday morning, all of them would have been dead. But it was a Sunday and they weren't at work. So this guy, Les Ludwig, from the Washington State Division of Industrial Safety and Health, said after the eruption that in April, which is the month in between the warning and the eruption, they were getting complaints from the workers of the logging companies that they didn't feel safe going to work. And he says at the end, "I thought that most of the complaints were from people who wanted a way to get out of work. Frankly, I thought they were out to get unemployment compensation. I wouldn't want this to get out in the press, but that's what I thought." So there's like, there is no level to which laziness does not come first among things wrong with you when you're unemployed. And I was reading this, I read a lot of book about disasters in the pandemic. And I remember I read that and I sat up and I was like, Jesus.
You know, again, if you don't know the story of Mount St. Helens, it was so clear that it was going to erupt that they had geologists and photographers just camped out looking at it all the time. And the reason that we have some of the images we have is because people who actually died in that explosion were there filming and taking pictures all the time.
I could talk about Mount St. Helens for a long time, but I think it's indicative of the view in the 70s that unemployed people were bad. Mm-hmm. And it overlaps with the financial reality that states no longer have a war chest. And so they've got to raise taxes on every business in their state
to refill that war chest.
Yeah, or they have to let benefits slide.
Right.
And so they let benefits slide. And at this point, the federal government starts a commission that says, we need to reform unemployment insurance. And it's like a multi-year commission. They meet, I think they started in 76. They come up with a final report and they're like, here's all the things we need to do about unemployment insurance. And businesses are at the table and labor unions at the table. And we've got all these people here talking about what unemployment insurance needs. The commission comes out, Democrats lose the election, Reagan is president. Everything that the commission says is put in a drawer and completely ignored. All right, so this problem gets worse. And then we get to the 90s and we have another like pretty brutal long recession in early 90s and unemployment insurance is failing. Mm-hmm. And it's not just failing workers, it's failing the national economy. This is a critical source of macroeconomic stabilization. In other words, people lose their jobs, they stop spending money, the economy shrinks, and this is an infusion of cash directed to the most adversely hurt in a recession mm-hmm. that not only helps them prop up their lives, but prop up the spending that is our economy.
Right, right, right.
So in the 90s, they're like, you know what we need? The commission. We need a big old commission, and we should get all these people at the table and do a big commission on how to fix unemployment. And Democrats lose the midterms, and so when it comes out, the 1998 Republican Congress is like, or hear me out, we just shut down government completely and it's completely ignored.
And were the findings of these two commissions similar? Yeah. And what did they think it should stay being managed at the state level?
Yeah, both of them did, but they wanted it to be kind of like more triggers for automatic tax increases, more design on the federal level. If you have to have certain minimums of your tax and benefit system that rise with the federal government. And then a lot of stuff that's like, hey, maybe it should be larger for old people because losing your job at 25 and losing your job at 55 are two very, very different things. It's serving both populations poorly because it's almost too generous to young workers who could get reemployed historically really quickly and ungenerous for older workers who have a really hard time getting reemployed after a layoff.
Hmm.
If you're keeping count, this is the second national commission in 3 decades to reform a program. Nothing's happened. Then the Great Recession hits,
mm-hmm.
and it's just
a bloodbath.
Bloodbath, an absolute catastrophe for all of these trust funds. They have to, when they run out of money, they have to borrow the money from the federal government. That means that they automatically have to raise taxes on every employer in their state, like in the depth of the Great Recession, in order to start paying back the federal government. And the Government Accountability Office releases a report that's like, you have to raise your taxes. You cannot starve your trust funds. And instead, at least half of states slash benefits and basically decide they're going to starve the program. And then, of course, businesses are complicit in this because they hire people. Talx was the name of the company, T-A-L-X. It's now Equifax Workforce Solutions, who has declined to sponsor us for the show. But Equifax Workforce Solutions basically tells employers, I'll handle all of your unemployment insurance yeah. claims. So if a worker who is laid off and is eligible for unemployment insurance makes a claim to the state to say, I need to get this benefit, their former employer has to certify that they lost their job through no fault of their own, and the employer has a window of time to do this. It's typically 21 days. What someone like Equifax Workforce Solutions will do is they'll handle all those claims, sit on them for exactly 21 days, and wait until the last possible day to send it back, by which point the unemployed worker has probably gotten so frustrated or so desperate that they've taken another job or they've given up on the claim being paid. So during the pandemic, I sent easily 50 reporters to the Equifax Workforce Solutions landing page in which they bragged openly about how much money they saved employers by paying out less in claims. And I said to a reporter, the only way to save money on unemployment insurance is to prevent people from getting it who are eligible. So that is what they are claiming to do in the landing page of Equifax Workforce Solutions. And then one reporter was like, I think they moved it. She called me and I was like, I'll find
it. So I just want to back up one second. If you're a company and you've laid people off, you've been paying this tax all along, that tax has gone into a trust fund. What benefit to you is there of having Equifax Workforce Solutions prevent people from getting the benefit that you've already contributed toward? Does that make sense?
Yes. And this is where we come to what has to be the worst designed feature of a public program that I have ever encountered, and that is called experience rating.
Oh.
The unemployment insurance tax.
I'm having flashbacks.
Are you remembering the glory days? Yeah. The unemployment insurance tax that businesses have to pay, that's a per cap on you. I mean, it's not that high. It varies based on how many people they send into the program.
So one company's tax rate is completely different from a different company's tax rate.
Based on the number of successful claims. So say you have two companies. They both have 1,000 employees. They've both been paying unemployment insurance taxes on those 1,000 employees' wages. The economy goes a little south, and they both decide to lay off 100 people. One company has 100 people laid off, and all 100 successfully claim unemployment insurance. The other company has 100 people laid off, but only 10 successfully claim unemployment insurance. The company that had more workers enroll and claim unemployment insurance will face a higher tax on all of its current and future workers for a period that could last to 5 years. So now these two companies with 900 workers left, the one that had more workers get unemployment insurance has higher taxes on all 900 workers as opposed to the one that just had 10.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's not smart. It didn't come from a bad place.
It didn't come from nowhere, but right.
Didn't come from a bad place. It was the philosophy of prevention that if employers had to pay for sending people to unemployment, that they would lay off fewer people. And there's evidence that to this day, we do have slightly less layoffs because businesses don't want to pay a higher unemployment tax. So it's kind of like workers' compensation. If you have to pay a tax that's based on the number of people that get injured on your work site, you're going to make a safer work site. You're going to prevent injury from occurring because that's cheaper for you. They kind of applied the same idea to unemployment. And
yeah, I mean, I can sort of see that's trying to incentivize not just laying people off willy-nilly at any old time.
Right, but what actually incentivizes is not letting people onto the program.
Right, it's actually incentivizing something different. And also it's punishing employers. It kind of kicks them when they're down.
I mean, employers are basically incentivized to not have workers get the benefit. And at the same time, state legislatures aren't going to be like, great news, we're going to raise taxes on every employer in our state. I mean, unemployed workers are ephemeral. These businesses are there always. This is a permanent constituency advocating for lower taxes, lower benefits, and lower participation. And there's just mayflies of workers who come in and realize how terrible the program is, but then they leave again. And there's no
permanent— They go get a job and then they're not concerned with it anymore.
No, there's no permanent constituency for better unemployment. So yeah, I mean, you just have all those problems. Put them on a timer, set it for 75 years, forget it, and you'll end up with the awful system that we have today, which is completely unprepared for a recession. The federal government now basically has to stand up an unemployment insurance program in the middle of a recession to make sure people actually get benefits And then they wind it back down again. And it enters this like cycle of, oh my God, the economy is crashing. We need to help unemployed people. Let's get them money. Let's get them benefits. Let's get a lot of people enrolled. And then like 6 months later, they're like, these lazy people do not want to work. We need to claw back all these benefits. This is not good policy making. It's not, not good.
This is not good.
This is me as an economist telling you officially, we would call this not good. We could do a lot better.
The federal government almost always steps in to top up benefits. That's what they did in the pandemic. Do they just essentially supersede the state program and say, I don't care what Florida says. I don't care what North Carolina says. You're going to get 26 weeks.
Yeah, there's a complex trigger system based on the unemployment rate in the state at the time versus whatever the federal government decides to do on top of that. So there are some automatic increases in benefits based on the unemployment rate in the state, as well as some that the federal government adds on. The federal government has intervened in unemployment insurance in every recession since the 1950s.
That enough should tell you that the state level systems aren't adequate to the facing a recession anyway.
Yeah, in each successive recession, the scope and the scale of their intervention has gotten bigger and bigger. And the pandemic intervention was huge. It was wild. So, I mean, keep in mind, we're talking about a program that at most will serve a half of unemployed people, but typically serves closer to a third because you have to have lost your job through no fault of your own, have worked previously, and have your employer certify it. And you have to be willing and available to work. It's rare to be more than half of unemployed people who are on unemployment insurance.
It will still only get half of people who should get it.
It's like half twice over because of people who would be eligible for unemployment insurance, typically at most half will pick it up. But of people who are unemployed, meaning that they don't have a job and they're actively looking for work, no more than half are typically even eligible for unemployment. So on average, around a quarter of the unemployed
are actually getting unemployment insurance.
Are actually getting benefits. Yeah. So it's much better to think of it as it's layoff insurance as opposed to unemployment insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed for factory workers in like 1925. So a lot of ways it doesn't fit.
Yeah.
In those times, like a factory would shut down for the winter or there would be a slow season and they would put everybody on temporary layoff and say, you're not going to work for the next 3 months because we don't have any orders. And then they would go on unemployment insurance and they would come back. And we don't have that now.
We had some of that in Hollywood when a show production would shut down and they would go on unemployment insurance. But that was the only example I can think of now.
Sometimes you'll have like seasonal workers, like you're hired for a department store and then you're laid off at the end, but you have to have worked enough in order to actually get the benefit.
Yeah.
2 months of work is not going to cut it.
No.
So it serves nobody well.
Mm-hmm.
That's unemployment insurance today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just do like a quick reiteration of the problems. It's underfunded. It's not that generous. It varies too much across states. It has a terrible financing scheme. And it's also so critically important to the economy in a recession that the federal government has to repeatedly step in to prop it up to the point where states have now learned what is arguably the correct lesson that it doesn't matter if they ignore these programs because the federal government will fix it when it counts. So, it's not going to get better. There are some states that will produce heroic efforts for unemployment in their states. So, if you want to go lose a job, go lose a job in New Jersey or Washington, Massachusetts, Colorado. Outside of that, it gets dodgy quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
California has somewhat generous benefits, but it is a grossly underfunded program. And they have raised their benefit. This is like such a catastrophe of liberalism. They've raised their benefits so many times and they've never raised their tax.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like California.
And they're expanding benefits. Like there's lots of states that are trying to find like undocumented workers to help get them into the program and get them benefits. But California's got to get that tax up. So for about 50 years now, this has been a problem. So I'm not necessarily optimistic about unemployment insurance turning around. What I am optimistic about is a new program.
Just start from scratch on this.
Yeah, I mean, I would start from scratch on the worker side, I think you could repurpose on the employer side. You have a tax on businesses that they pay into a trust fund. Right now, it goes to workers. By the way, red flag. They're paying a tax that someone else gets. But if you had a tax that instead of going to workers, went instead back to businesses, where the trust fund and the insurance program is all, what do they say, B2B? To me, it makes policy design sense that the people who benefit from the program are the people who pay for it in a social insurance scheme. We're going to also red flag that this is something liberals hate me for saying, but you could imagine a repurposed unemployment insurance trust fund that basically runs like the PPP did during the pandemic, where it's a grant to businesses who are going through things like there's a recession or there's a disruption to business that comes from construction. There's a disruption to business that comes from a natural disaster. And they have their own insurance trust fund that they apportion out. I didn't love the PPP program during the pandemic, probably because it just had such an incredible amount of fraud. But I do think that there's a need to have a support for businesses when the economy is in trouble. And at the moment, they really don't have much.
And just to remind people, the PPP plan meant you got money if you kept your people employed.
Yes, and it was rife with fraud. The number of people in Congress who got it is wild. There's no reason why, just because it was so fraud-ridden in the pandemic,
you would have to be fraud-ridden in the future.
Yeah, and that. I mean, I think there are some state governments that would be like, we could do this really well. Like, we could manage mm-hmm. this money incredibly well. I'm sure some states would be like, our businesses don't need it, but whatever. But I could see some like state workforce and industrial boards being like, we could manage an insurance program that helps businesses keep people on payroll very well. And then leave that to the states, because businesses move less than people do. So that's the business side. On the worker side, my dream for unemployment, I heard one person describe it as crazy. I wrote out all these plans for like what I would do for an unemployment program. And it's like, I've never seen conservatives and liberals so united in disliking something. I know that this show has a progressive liberal bent, but y'all, I can get liberal people mad at me so fast. Like, y'all don't even know.
Oh, I do. I know. Yeah.
So here's my like dream system that unites liberals and conservatives in their dislike.
In their hatred of Catherine.
In their hatred of the system.
In the Edwards Republic, this is what we would have.
The Edwards Republic, this is actually one long executive order.
That you've been noodling on since graduate school.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
all right. So I think we should support unemployed people. You cannot say that without saying, undoubtedly, if you give someone who doesn't have a job cash, they will stay unemployed longer. I am fine with that. I think there are good and bad consequences to having people who don't have a job have financial cushion that doesn't rely on their past savings or more likely their parents mm-hmm. or their partner. There is an overwhelming amount of evidence that only goes in one direction, that the more generous unemployment benefits are, the longer someone will stay unemployed.
I'm sorry, what do you mean they only go in?
I mean, like, there's not a lot of studies that's like, if I gave someone $100 versus $1,000 on unemployment, or if I gave them 4 weeks of unemployment or 15 weeks of unemployment, that they would all find a job at the same rate. However, there are very few studies that find more generous unemployment prevents reemployment.
And so the question is, what are you investing in and what are we getting out of that cushion?
I think you just got to be comfortable saying, I'm willing to give more money, which could lead to higher unemployment rates for people who don't have a job, to support the job search, to support and invest in better re-employment for people who are unemployed.
Can we?
This is why. This is why.
Say that again.
I got to say that again. Okay. This is why. All right.
There were a lot of words there, and they were all the same.
Okay. Throwback to earlier in the episode, podcasting, just getting some words out, brought to you by Equifax Workforce Solutions. Oh, man. There's going to be a meeting on the Eastern Seaboard in the fog with someone from like Big Cinnamon and Equifax Workforce Solutions and Starbucks being like, we've got to shut this place down.
Yeah. There are 3,000 listeners. Storm the gates.
Okay. So my starting point would say, that the conservative pushback against unemployment benefits in any form, whether what I propose or what currently exists, is that if you give someone out of work money, it will take them longer to find a job. That mm-hmm. is true. Mm-hmm. The question is, do you care? Catherine doesn't care.
Right.
Because right. they don't, there's not evidence that if you give someone unemployed money, they'll never find a job. It's right. really about how long it takes them to find one. The conservative take would be you're extending unemployment, which is true, mm-hmm. but my bent would be you're investing in re-employment, i.e. them finding a better job. Because mm-hmm. if I lose my job and I have nothing, I have to take the first worst job I can find. If I lose my job and I've got like $3,000 of cushion, I can wait as long as possible to try and find the best job possible.
Right. And that could mean one with better hours. It could be one closer to you. It could be one that a closer match to your skills. I mean, those are all the things that people are balancing when they're trying to figure out where can I get something quickly, but that's really worth it.
Yeah. And I think that this is better for the economy. I mean, like, I like helping people and I'm sympathetic to workers, but at the end of the day, I'm a heartless economist. And your skills and education and experience are referred to as your human capital. Mm-hmm. And the skills and education and experience of all workers in the U.S. is our American economy-wide human capital. If you work at some job and get fired or laid off or quit and you restart as, say, someone mopping the floors at Starbucks, your human capital, everything that you learned from the prior job, I mean, it's basically wasted because you're now in a job where you don't use it at all, which means it doesn't benefit the economy at all. Mm-hmm. All the skills and experience you had, it's gone. And we've invested in you and the economy benefits from that human capital, but we're essentially in the process of destroying it because every time you lose your job, you have to start over. That's not efficient. It's not productive. It's not good for our economy. Mm-hmm. I don't care about workers or people or what they do, but I care about economic potential. And I know that that comes from human capital in a service-oriented economy like the one that we have. So no, you want to
fight about workers.
I mean, I do. I mean, but okay, don't tell anybody. But yeah, of course I care about workers. But like that is the cold-hearted economic argument of like, yeah, your sob story about you losing your job aside, like there is a cold-hearted calculus here. Mm-hmm. I've invested in you and I don't want to see that investment thrown away.
It's funny, I feel like that requires people seeing both at the like individual level, but also a much bigger picture. And everybody who just wants to look at, you know, it's like not the forest or the trees, right? Yeah. Just like just this little grove, which is the business aspect of the whole thing. How much incentive and pressure can we put on people to come back to get to take the jobs that we want them to take because we're trying to fill them probably for less money than the market would bear?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, if we had a system of no unemployment, no one who became unemployed ever got any type of public help, have the cushion of a long unemployment are those people who had earned enough to have savings, have rich parents or family members, and that's it. And that's not a predictor of the most valuable people in our economy or our human capital investment. Instead, you'd have a lot of people who would quit their job and like immediately get some low wage one or drive for Uber, and you're wasting human capital.
I mean, and I think you see this in, for instance, the college graduates, right?
Yeah.
They're to me, an example of exactly what you're talking about. They've invested somehow in an education. They've come out. They're not eligible for unemployment. And they wind up being forced to take the first job that they can get, which is not necessarily the best place for them to actually start a career.
No, it's not. And even though they'll get past it, and I think they'll recover from it because they are really young, that's the same problem that is more severe if instead of being a 22-year-old college graduate, they were a 32-year-old who had been working for 10 years. Because you're losing more human capital at every step, and the labor market might punish you for it.
Or gone back to school and got a master's degree.
Exactly. So that I think it's worth saying that the conservative argument here is right. I just don't think it's the most important argument. I basically think that anybody who wants unemployment should be able to go out and get it. And that if the program is designed correctly, you can manage the incentives of how you get it. So I kind of envision having like a tiered unemployment system. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, which I guess over where we've been for the last 5 years, the answer would probably be not. The median unemployment spell in the U.S. is pretty short. It's about 10 weeks. And since it's a median, that means that for half of people who are unemployed, they will get a job in less than 10 weeks. Now, for the other half, it's a lot longer. And in fact, the average unemployment spell is almost double that. And when you have that much dispersion between a median and an average, it means you have big tail effects, where you have a lot of people who get a job really quickly and a lot of people who don't get a job that quickly at all. Mm-hmm. The unemployment insurance system that we currently have absolutely ignores all of this. It's just one length of benefit for everyone who successfully enrolls in the program. That's not what we know about the unemployed. And in the base case for a lot of states, it's 26 weeks. Well, that doesn't make sense. 26 is an arbitrary number. We know that in good times, you don't need to be unemployed for 6 months. We know that if you're young, you're reemployed really quickly. You don't need to be unemployed for 6 months. But like in a recession, if you're an older worker, if it's a layoff where like your factory closed and there's no other factory in your town, that's very different from, you know, they cut your shift at a retail store and there's four more open next to you. So we know so much about unemployment and who has a harder time and who needs help, and none of it is incorporated into the current system. So I think we could just come up with a flexible design that's basically what I think of as a progressive tiered system, where anybody can get unemployment who wants it. But the first tier is like really short. It's basically like a 2 to 3 week benefit that pays out at a decent rate. But if you need more, you have to go back and get a tier two benefit, which comes with things like you have to get employment counseling and set yourself up with a counselor. You have to have basically like a prognosis made of like re-employment opportunities and things like that. And if that runs out, you end up in tier three unemployment, which would kick you over into things like tuition assistance for training or, you know, wraparound services so that if you go into full-time training, you can get, you know, like food stamps for your family and things like that. And the benefit is basically morphed to support not leaving the labor force, but basically keeping you in. So like each tier is like a longer time, less money, and more involvement with a caseworker to help you get reassigned into what you need, whether that's, you know, school or training or what have you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't see it going that direction. I thought I saw it going like the longer you're on it, you're going to get less. But in fact, the point of not letting workers become discouraged workers, detached from the workforce, people who aren't looking for jobs anymore, if that's the goal of the system, you'd make a very different program.
It would be a very different program. And one thing that has been shown pretty definitively, and that a lot of state programs are trying to incorporate to some level, is that a lot of people who are looking for jobs benefit from counseling, like job seeker counseling, especially if you've worked one job for a long time or if you're new to the labor market. Like, you don't have a full sense of the economic opportunities within your reach or types of jobs there are or employers that are looking. And so having counseling sessions of like, you can get your check, but you need to come in and we're going to talk about like what job postings are up right now, this human intervention of helping people who are looking for work. I mean, they can have a really high payoff if it's done well. So you just build that into the program. You want to go from tier one to tier two? Fine. You have to have an hour-long meeting with someone who's going to like size up your labor market potential. And so it's a way to introduce services and assistance while basically kind of keeping people like afloat, but not adrift. And then you would have some type of like lifetime penalty that like if you have a tier one benefit where you, no questions asked, got some money from unemployment, you know, if you try to get it again, it's a lot less and it penalizes you. You know, something that like the incentives to use the system appropriately are built into how the money plays out over successive spells.
So I can understand why conservatives hate your big unemployment ideas. Why do liberals hate it?
Because the default benefit would be a lot shorter. Right now, when you become laid off, and if you successfully enroll in unemployment insurance, you can get 6 months of benefits in a lot of states. You know, my new system would say you should get two or three, you know, maybe four. But remember that the median duration of unemployment is really low. Normally, you don't need to have three times the duration of an unemployment spell and weekly benefit amounts. So I just think that this default into a high number is wrong, and we should default people into a really low number and then just kind of expand the program kind of in response to the person, as opposed to kind of erring on the side of everybody gets a lot of unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
We know so much about the labor market and unemployment, winners and losers, because we have 160 million people working,
mm-hmm.
transitioning through 1.5 million layoffs a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, millions of quits, millions of hires, millions of transfers. Like we see so much data and evidence coming in of what the trajectories are and what varies it. I also think that this would help support a training system.
A better job training system.
A better job training reemployment system. I think you could basically pitch it as like an automation technology, AI.
Yeah, that's
kind of salve of like, look, if you're worried about AI taking jobs, the only reason why that's scary is because unemployment sucks. So like, let's build an amazing unemployment program that does things like retraining in the face of rapidly shifting technology. And let's make that a right for all workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that the Anthropic CEO just today, I think, was out saying again, well, we don't know that AI is going to take all of these jobs, but the probability is high enough that we feel like we need to warn everybody, you know.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, they don't know, but
they don't know.
Like, okay, sure, like, take them on face value. It's going to, like, if someone told you there is a technology that is going to eradicate 5 million jobs in the next 10 years, what are you going to do? I would go right to the unemployment and training system and make sure it's prepared to take 5 million people whose long-term labor prospects have been severely altered because of a technology that won't be reversed. And I would come up with a multi-tiered unemployment system for catching them and helping them find the appropriate services given their age and experience and education and labor market trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are incredibly knowledgeable about unemployment insurance are mostly hostile to it because it essentially abandons the program.
They're mostly hostile to your idea.
They're hostile to this idea on both sides. I had a version of this idea published in the New York Times as an op-ed, and like one of the responses I got on Twitter was like, I normally respect everything Catherine Edwards says, but not here. And I was like,
okay,
damn, tough. That one stings. But I, for what it's worth, I also think that we could do more for unemployed people that doesn't involve money. I put this in a column for Bloomberg a couple of years ago where I think that we should have a new set of labor regulations related to job seekers.
Oh, just make like the job hunting. I mean, job hunting is so, it's so bad and getting, it seems like getting worse.
It's awful.
It's awful.
Job hunting is awful. I mean, you could put a piece of legislation that says if you are posting a job, you have to say what your timeline is for hiring. How long, like when the position will be filled by, you have to give a timeline of filling and you have to notify people if they don't get the job.
Yeah. God, no kidding. Like it's like being ghosted by 100 companies, you know.
Just forbid ghosting. Like they know they're not going to hire you. They have all the information. Believe it or not, they have your contact information and the knowledge that they're not going to hire you. But, just make them say it.
No kidding.
Just make them say, like, within receiving an application, you have, like, 30 days, you know, or you have, like, a timeline posted for the position. And now there's lots of ways employers will try to get around that of, like, this is a hire that we'll make over the next 5 years, you know, but then people won't apply for it. So I think you could use the market power of job seekers in a direction to put some requirements on people who post jobs. And then I am, like, 100,000% in favor of paying people for interview time. The amount of work that people have to go through of like, you have 6 interviews, you have an on-site, we need a presentation, you need to prepare things for us. And after this presentation, like now you have to do this, like you need to take this
test.
You need to do this coding assignment. That's fine. You want to make people jump through that many hoops, you have to compensate them for their time at the pay that the position requires. So if you want 2 days of work out of someone, you need to pay them for 2 days of work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a bunch of people would say that's a horrible idea because now people would be less incentivized to have job openings.
Or less incentivized to look at a wide variety of candidates, especially in the era of anti-DEI sentiment.
Yeah, but at the same time, here's what like we shouldn't tell any employer is that having them put out notifications of who doesn't get a job and paying people for their time for the compensation would actually be a lot of really great data for the EEOC to enforce anti-discrimination and hiring laws.
Hmm.
Ah. Because you're making them give up information that could be used as the basis of a lawsuit of like, we don't see that you discriminated in hiring and you're supposed to hire people of different races and genders at the same rate. But actually, it turns out that all the people that got rejected were Black and you interviewed all the white people. Like, I think it would generate a ton of data that could be used in our pocket as opposed to relying on their behavior. And yeah, I think job seekers are treated with such indignity that you could put some laws on their regulation.
Yeah, I think that making that experience more humane for people would go a long way.
It would go a long way. Then they can go to someone like an unemployment counselor to say, like, here are the 50 jobs that I got rejected from. I completed the application fully and I'm not getting the job. That then also becomes data for people like me studying labor market strength to use to say, we've got people on unemployment because they're holding a stack of rejections 100 high, like the labor market is freezing up and we're not relying on like just one hiring rate produced with a 2-month lag from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We've got real-time data that job seekers are unduly suffering right now. I think it plays to so many advantages. There are potential costs. They're there. And it would make things harder for employers in the hiring process. And yet, my heart rate's what it was 30 seconds ago, and I'm fine. And I think that,
I don't feel like recruiters feel like the hiring process is working for them right now either. It's deeply broken and partly broken by AI.
Oh, yeah. Make them put up there, like, when you reject someone, you have to say if they were screened by a human or AI. That's a law.
Yeah, that would be a good one. That would be a good one.
I'm sure they'll lie. I'm sure they'll say like, yeah, a human sent the send on the email that the AI told him to send. But, you know, design an incentive is tough, but it's a lot tougher if you don't have anything. I'm going to come up with a version of job seeker protection that involves like notification, information, compensation for time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm sure employers will get around it in 6 months. That's fine. I can try again. But I can't try at all if we don't even have the notion in our economy that job seekers deserve more than what they currently get. And if we can build into our economy that job seekers deserve more, then we can do more. And I think I'm optimistic that the only way the specter of AI works in workers' favor is if they take them as seriously as these Anthropic and, you know, whatever CEOs,
Open AI
and Anthropic and all these people are like, here's how it's going to change the world. Fine. I'm not going to believe this is a PR campaign to go after sunk cost and investment that has no clear return or market. I'm going to take you on face value and we're going to redesign labor laws and we're going to redesign unemployment.
Right. I like it. If we could get only that out of the AI hype machine, if we could get better job application environment for people, it would be worth listening to Unbearable Sam Altman, you know, again.
And you know what, optimist, like, really don't lose faith here. I have briefed committees behind closed door of Congress about exactly this. And I have said that the only way to truly protect workers from whatever is coming from AI is to take the job loss that they predict on face value and build, you know, a formidable unemployment program that puts power back with workers. And I have talked like directly to members of Congress about this. So, you know, this is not something that's like pie in the sky of like, oh, wouldn't it be great? Like, this is something that members of Congress know is coming. And, you know, to the extent that I actually had contact with them, if that gives you hope, it gave me hope.
Gives me hope.
Okay.
If I listen to you, they're all, yeah. Even if they're not listening to me.
Also, y'all could not get worse than the system we have.
That for sure.
Right? Sometimes the greatest success is built off the lowest bar. And I'll take it. Optimist economy. We say words that are recorded for a podcast. You're welcome. Let's get to our executive orders.
Executive orders. Would you like to go first?
Oh, no, you can go first. Yours is so on point.
Mine's on point. I'm actually borrowing an executive order this week from Roman Lutz of Seattle, who sent actually a long list of executive orders in, but this one seemed particularly relevant this week. If a company does a layoff, the C-suite cannot get raises or bonuses for 3 years. And if, like me, you didn't know what the C-suite was until I went to work for a company, these are all the people who are like, not just the CEO, but the CFO, COO. That is the executive level of a company.
I say this with a lot of love. So those bastards would create a D suite that does get paid. slippery as a wet fish. But that just means we have to stay vigilant.
Okay. Excellent. So what's your executive order?
Mine is that you cannot be appointed to a federal agency that you would not be qualified to work at. So if you are nominated for a Senate-confirmed position, you have to simultaneously submit an anonymous resume to an opening at that agency. And if you don't get hired at the bottom, you can't
lead
at the top.
It. Yeah.
And I think this would actually be an incredibly helpful screening mechanism.
Hard agree.
Hard agree. Incredibly effective screening mechanism that, I'm kind of like, and who wants to be, like, who's going to champion not this? I have an idea.
I do too.
I have a couple agencies.
Yeah.
But that was inspired by someone pointing out that the guy nominated to run the Bureau of Labor Statistics would never get a job there. It was brought up by someone in a really mean way.
Yeah.
But it was fair. Like, he was unqualified for an entry-level economist position at that agency. I tried to work at the BLS and applied there, and I didn't make it through because I didn't have enough survey experience in my dissertation.
Because you're busy looking at unemployment insurance.
I'm like, my focus is like, the set of people that you don't really...
You've made a strange choice, Ms. Edwards.
They didn't have an opening at the employment desk. They only had an opening up at the price desk. And the price desk people were like, how much do you know about prices? And I was like, I pay them. And they're like, we might go with someone who knows something about prices. And I was like, you know what? That's actually such a good choice. Y'all are so good at this.
Yeah.
I should not be working at the price desk. I should be working at the employment desk. So.
All right. It's time for spiritual sponsors. Your spiritual sponsor this week.
Oh, I was driving in the car and the radio delivered an absolute gem of playing Radiohead's No Surprises. Mm. And man, is that a good song. So I have a two-way spiritual sponsor of when the radio delivers something that you love.
Exactly.
Which is such a good feeling.
It's like winning the jackpot.
Oh, God, it does feel like winning the lottery. Some random person figured out that you needed to hear
that song
No
right
Surprises
now.
And that you hadn't in forever. So both the song No Surprises, mm-hmm. which I do think is one of the millennial lullabies, and mm-hmm. hearing a song that you love on the radio that you haven't heard in forever and that they deliver to you at the perfect moment.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. My spiritual sponsor this week is public libraries everywhere. Tip of the hat to our listener, Julie Martinez, who suggested this and who said she particularly loves the Ann Arbor, Michigan public library system. I love the Los Angeles Central Library, specifically in downtown Los Angeles, and of course, the branch system as well, but the Central Library is a beautiful building. Librarians are among my favorite people in the world, but also the Spokane Central Library, which was like a home away from home when we moved to Spokane.
Oh my God, the MLK Library in Washington, D.C. It's just named after him. It's not like a presidential library, but oh my God, the MLK Library in downtown D.C. First off, if you have kids under 10 and you visit our nation's capital, you have to go to this library because it has a slide down the stairs from the children's section. It's almost like a bowling alley of like the really slick wood. Kids just fly. I mean, they fly down it. It's almost two stories. And it's right off of the mall. It's so close to the Portrait Gallery. And most people don't know, like, you just have to go inside this massive library, take a right turn, and you'll hear children screaming with delight as they fly down from the children's section. Oh, man, that would be a good spiritual sponsor, is the slide down the MLK library. I had to do it once with maybe a little person who was a little nervous to do it by
Aww.
Themselves.
Aww.
And I was like, Jesus. I was like, man, you're like about to clock some G's going down this thing. Maybe it was like too much weight going down, just the right slickness, but like, whoof, flew.
If people haven't read it, there's a book about the LA Central Library called The Library Book by Susan Orlean that is terrific. And it tells the whole history of the library and the librarians, but all through the lens of there was a fire at the Central Library that kept the library closed for ages and destroyed tons and tons of books and was sort of solved as an arson, but a little unresolved. Anyway, it's a terrific read, especially if you like libraries.
Oh, librarians. I do. Seattle downtown has an amazing public
library.
Oh, yeah,
that's a great library.
Austin's downtown library is an incredible library, and it's built over a bike path. So they built like a bike repair shop, like a DIY bike repair shop, and like classes on how to repair your bike on the bike path that passes underneath the downtown library.
The LA Public Library has ukuleles you can check out, and I actually learned to play the ukulele at classes at the Central Library. Like, there's just, yeah, the great things that the librarians do.
Also, this would be a plug to say that the American Library Association has such a sleeper hit of a merch store.
Oh, yeah. This is where you got your Reading Rainbow shirt.
Not just that, but also they have like so many great slogans about reading and not banning books. Mm. But one that I personally love is they had Freed Between the Lines.
Mm.
I like that one. I have that one on a shirt and like a couple stickers and also a poster. I cannot recommend the ALA store enough. And it's all, a lot of it is around banned books. And then that's where you can get all of the Read posters. So every Read poster you've ever had in a library, they sell a lot of them. And actually the way that I discovered this store, this is worth it. No, don't cut it, Sophie. Is that when David Bowie died, they did a special reprint where you could reorder his Read poster. And so they reissued it at his death, which I think they had printed it in like the 80s, and they reissued it so you could buy the Read poster from David Bowie. So I have it framed. I'm like looking at it right now. I have it framed right here. But I also bought it for my sister-in-law, who is a massive David Bowie fan, and I didn't tell her it was coming. I just sent it to her in the mail. So like, she was devastated when Bowie died. My husband was like, we should just send it and not tell her it's from us and just let it arrive in the mail one day. And I was like,
solid.
That's so perfect. And then since then, they've taken so much of my money, which is good because they're libraries and they deserve it. And I get to look at David Bowie. He's reading The Idiot.
Nice. Anyway, public libraries, we love them.
That's our show.
That's our show. If you need to get in touch with us, you can always do that by email at optimist.economy@gmail.com. We're on Instagram, we're on TikTok, and we're on LinkedIn. So you can follow us on any of those places for updates. Also, you can get our newsletter on Substack.
And we're also on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
And listeners, this is normally the point where we would snap out Andy and Sophie, but we can't. We had to fire them both for Charlie Kirk comments. Yeah, sorry, everyone. They hated freedom. So we don't have producers on the show, which is why it got so bad. Just kidding. Oh, the Onion article? You're going to be fired for reading this? Yes, Sophie, I read it. It's so
oh my
good.
God.
At the end of the show, we have to snap out Andy and Sophie. Thank you so much for your production assistance, for
and
your editing.
Good studio chat.
In your amazing studio chat to just, I would say, both support us and sabotage us as we try to keep it professional. I wouldn't have it any other way,
no,
honestly.
Not really.
No.
Okay.
This was not brought to you by Equifax Workforce Solutions.